walk whore and urge Phil to do things she'd never allowed Stan to do and say things she'd never once said to Stan. Jocelyn, smiling a tight but lip-licking smile, likes to watch Stan watching. Then she wants him to recreate these videos, playing Phil with her in the role of Charmaine. The horrible thing is that sometimes he can, though it's equally horrible when he can't. If he roughs her up and fucks her, it's because she told him to. If he isn't up to it, he's a failure. So, whichever it is, he loses. Jocelyn has transformed the neutral sofa with its bland lilies into a nest of torturous and humiliating vice. He can barely sit down on it anymore. Who knew that a harmless consumer good made of fabric and stuffing could become such a crippling head games weapon? He hopes Jocelyn has been recording these scenes and will make Phil watch them in his turn. She's mean enough for it. No doubt Phil's wondering why he's still in prison and is trying bluster. "There's been a mistake. I'm supposed to be leaving now. Just let me contact my wife. She's in surveillance. We'll get this straightened out." Stan takes an acidic pleasure in imagining this scenario, as well as the stonewalling stares and hidden snickering among the guards, because haven't they got their orders, which come from higher up? "Just cool it, buddy. Look at the printout. Positron identity numbers don't lie. The system's hack-proof." That twisted fuckwit Phil had it coming. Holding this thought keeps Stan going during his sexual command performances with Jocelyn, which are a good deal more like tenderizing a steak than anything he finds purely pleasurable.
"Oh, Stan,"
comes the pert, giggly pseudo-voice of Charmaine.
"You get a kick out of it, you must. You know you do. Well, most of the time anyway, and every man has those letdown moments, but the rest of the time, don't think I can't hear those groans, which have to be enjoyable for you. Don't deny it."
"Ram it," he tells her. But Charmaine, with her angel face and devious heart, the real Charmaine, can't hear him. She can't know that Jocelyn's been messing with their lives, paying her back for stealing Phil. But on the first of the month, she'll find out. When she walks into this house, expecting to find Stan, it will be Phil who'll be waiting for her. He won't exactly be pleased about it either, would be Stan's guess, because a quick hit of supercharged nookie snatched on the run is not at all the same as all day, every day. That's when Charmaine will discover that the fire of her loins is not who she thinks he is, not the Max of her fever dreams, whose fake name she invokes over and over in those videos, but a much less alpha male, who will look very different in plain daylight. Saggier, older, but also jaded, shifty-eyed, calculating. You can see that in his face on the videos. She and Phil will be stuck with each other whether they like it or not. Charmaine will have to live with his dirty socks, his hairs in the sink. She'll have to listen to him snoring. She'll have to make small talk with him at breakfast. All of which will put a damper on the bodice ripper she's been acting out. How long will it take for the two of them to get bored, then fed up with each other? How long before Phil resorts to domestic violence just for something to do? Not long, Stan hopes. He wouldn't mind knowing that Phil is smacking Charmaine around, and not just as a garnish to sex, the way he does on screen, but for real. Somebody needs to. But Phil better not push it too far, or Charmaine may stick a grapefruit knife into his jugular, since behind that blonde puffball act of hers, there's something skewed. A chip missing, a loose connection. He hadn't recognized it when they'd been living together. He'd underestimated her shadow side, which was mistake number one, because everyone has a shadow side, even fluffpots like her. There's another thought, not so pleasant. When Phil and Charmaine take up domestic life in this house, what will become of him, Stan? He can't stay in the house with them, that's clear. Will Jocelyn spirit him away to a secret love nest and chain him to her bedpost? Or will she tire of treating him like an indentured stud muffin, of hot-wiring his mind and watching him jerk around like a galvanized frog, and let him re-enter Positron for a much-needed rest. Though maybe she'll alter the schedule even further. Maybe she'll just keep Stan here with her, playing her warped game of house, and let the other two cool their jets inside the slammer. Switchover day will roll around, and Charmaine and Phil will be all set to put on their civvies and beeline it to their seedy rendezvous, but then some gink in a uniform will tell them there's been a delay, and they won't be coming out of Positron right now, which will mean 3 months straight for Charmaine. She must be going nuts. Phil will already have guessed that Jocelyn has found him out, yet again. He'll wonder whether she's finally given up on him. He'll be in an advanced state of anxiety if he has any sense at all. He must know his wife is a vengeful harpy. Deep inside her business suit neutral cool and her long-suffering pose of tolerance. But Charmaine will be confused. She'll run through her gamut of girly manipulations with the Positron management. Dimpled blonde astonishment, lip quivering, outrage, tearful pleading. But none of it will do her any good. Then maybe she'll have a real meltdown. She'll lose it. She'll wail. She'll crumple to the floor. The officials won't put up with that. They'll haul her upright, hose her down. Stan would like to see that. It would be some satisfaction for the contempt with which she's been treating him. Maybe Jocelyn will let him watch on the spy cam. Not likely. His access to spy cam material is limited to Charmaine and Phil writhing around on the floor. Jocelyn really gets a jolt out of those. Her demand that he duplicate the action is pathetic. She must know he can't feel any real passion. At those moments, he'd drink paint thinner or stuff a chili pepper up his nose. Anything to dull his brain during these mutually humiliating scenes. But he needs to convince himself that he's next door to an automaton. He needs to keep the action going. His life may depend on it. Last night, Jocelyn tried something new. She has all the access codes to everything, as far as he can tell. So she opened Charmaine's pink locker and rummaged around in Charmaine's stuff and found a nightgown she could fit into. It had daisies on it and little bows. Very far from Jocelyn's functional style, which was maybe the point. Jocelyn is in the habit of sleeping in the spare room, where she also keeps her work, whatever it is. But last night, after lighting a scented candle, she'd put on that nightgown and tiptoed into his room.
"Surprise," she'd whispered.
Her mouth was dark with lipstick, and as she pressed it down on his, he'd recognized the aroma of the lipstick kiss on that note he'd found.
"I'm starved for you. I need you so much. XXOO, and you know what more. Jasmine."
Like a moron, he'd fallen for this sultry Jasmine, with her mouth the color of grape juice. What a mirage. Then, what a disappointment. And now Jocelyn wanted to be who? Dragged out of sleep, he was disoriented. For a moment, he didn't know where he was, or who was pressing herself against him.
"Just imagine I'm Jasmine," she murmured. "Just let yourself go."
But how could he, with the texture of Charmaine's familiar cotton nightgown under his fingers? The daisies, the bows. It was such a disconnect. How much longer can he go on starring in this bedroom farce without losing it completely and doing something violent? He can keep himself steady when he's working at the scooter depot. Solving mechanical problems levels him out. But as the workday nears its end, he feels the dread building. Then he has to get onto his scooter and motor back to the house. His goal is to dump a few beers into himself, then pretend to concentrate on yard work before Jocelyn turns up. It's risky to combine beer fog with power tools, but it's a risk he's willing to take. Unless he numbs himself, he might find himself doing something stupid. But Jocelyn is high up on the status ladder. She must have every one of her snatch hairs monitored, with a SWAT team ready to spring into lethal action at any threat. Stan would surely trigger some alarm while making even the most innocuous move against her, such as roping her up and stowing her in Charmaine's pink locker. No, not the pink one. He doesn't know the code. In his own red locker, while he makes his getaway. But getaway to where? There's no route out of Consilience. Not for those who've made the dick-brained mistake of signing themselves in. Signing themselves over. Due time now. Buy time for our future. You got suckered, says Connor's voice inside his head. Here comes Jocelyn in her darkened, softly purring spook vehicle. She must have a driver, because she always exits from the back seat. They're said to be working on a bunch of new robotic tech stuff at Positron that's going to help this place pay its way, so maybe it's a bot driving the car. He has a wild impulse to sprint over with the hedge trimmer, turn it on, threaten to shred both Jocelyn and her robot driver unless they take him to the main Consilience gateway right now. What if she calls his bluff and refuses? Will he go for it and be left with a dead car full of electronics and mangled body parts? But if it works, he'll make her drive him right through the gateway into the crumbling, semi-deserted wasteland outside the wall. He'll jump out of the car, make a break for it. He wouldn't have much of a life out there, picking through garbage dumps and fighting off scavengers, but at least he'd be in charge of himself again. He'll find Connor, or Connor will find him. If anyone knows how to play the angles out there, it will be Con. He'll have to eat his pride, though. Do some backtracking. I was wrong. I should have listened to you. And fucking etc. Though, maybe better not to try the hedge trimmer move on Jocelyn. She can probably activate the alarm system by flexing her toes, not to mention her fast moves. Those surveillance types must take martial arts training. Learn to crush windpipes with their thumbs. Now she's getting out of the car, feet first. Shoes, ankles, gray nylon. Any guy seeing those legs would have to be turned on. Wouldn't they? Hang on to that thought, Stan, he tells himself. It's not all downside. Part 6. Valentine's Day. Limbo. It's the 10th day of February, and Stan is still in limbo. Charmaine didn't reappear on the switchover day, as he'd been both hoping and fearing she would. Hoping because, he has to admit, he misses her and wants to see her, especially if she replaces Jocelyn. Fearing because would he lose his temper? Tell her he's seen the videos of her with Max? Confront her with all the lies she told him? Belt her one? The way Con might? Would she be defiant? Would she laugh at him? Or would she cry and say what a mistake she's made, and how sorry she is, and how much she loves him? And if she does say that, how will he know she means it? He himself would be on shaky ground. What if Jocelyn takes her side? What if she shares what she knows about Stan's pursuit of the fake Jasmine, and adds in a few details about what she and Stan had been doing on the blue sofa. And elsewhere. Many elsewheres. The inside of his head turns to a snarl of string every time he tries to picture his reunion with Charmaine. I think you two need more time apart, was what Jocelyn said about it, as if he and Charmaine were squabbling children who'd been given a time out by a loving but strict mother. No, not a mother, a decadent babysitter who'd shortly be charged with corrupting minors because right after that prissy little sermon, Stan found himself on the blue sofa with its chaste but by now grubby lilies enacting one of Jocelyn's favorite scenes from the frequently replayed video porn saga featuring their two energetic spouses. What if it were both of us at once? He found himself growling as if from a great distance. The voice was his, the words were Max's. The script called for some handwork here. It was hard to remember all the words, synchronize them with the gestures. How did they manage it in films? But those people got multiple takes. If they did it wrong, they could do it over. Front and back.
Oh, no, I couldn't,
Jocelyn replied in a voice intended to sound breathless and ashamed, like Charmaine's on the video. And it did kind of sound that way. She wasn't acting, or not entirely.
Not both at once. That's...
What came next? His mind went blank. To gain time, he tore off a few buttons.
I think you could,
Jocelyn prompted him.
I think you could, he said. I think you want to. Look, you're blushing. You're a dirty little slut, aren't you? When would this be over?
Why couldn't he just skip all the role-playing crap, cut to the chase, get to the part where her eyes rolled back in her head and she screamed like ripped metal? But she didn't want the short form. She wanted dialogue and ritual. She wanted courtship. She wanted what Charmaine had, right there on screen, and not a syllable less. It was pitiful. Once Stan stopped to think about it, as if she'd been left out, the one kid not invited to the birthday party. So she was going to have her own birthday party, all by herself. And she was having it all by herself, more or less, because Stan wasn't present in any real sense.
Why doesn't she just order herself a robot? He thought.
Among the guys down at the scooter depot, talk has it that full production has begun on the new and improved sex bots that are in the trial stage somewhere in the depths of Positron. Maybe it's an urban legend or wishful thinking, but the guys swear to it. They have the inside track. It's said to be a line of Dutch-designed prostibots, some for the domestic market, but the majority for export. The bots are supposed to be really lifelike, with body heat and touch-sensitive plastic fiber skin that actually quivers, and several different voice modes, and flushable interiors for sanitary purposes, because who wants to catch a dick-rotting disease? These bots will cut down on sex trafficking, say the boosters. No more young girls smuggled over borders, beaten into submission, chained to the bed, reduced to a pulp, then thrown into sewage lagoons. No more of that. Plus, they'll practically shit money. But it won't be anything like the real thing, say the detractors. You won't be able to look into their eyes and see a real person looking out. Oh, they've got a few tricks up their sleeves, say the boosters. Improved facial muscles, better software. But they can't feel pain, say the detractors. They're working on that feature, say the boosters. Anyway, they'll never say no. Or they'll say no only if you want them to. Stan doubts all of this. The empathy modules at Dimple Robotics wouldn't have convinced a 5-year-old. But maybe they've made strides. The guys joke about applying to be prostabot testers at Positron. It's said to be a wild experience, though creepy. You get to choose the voice and phrase option. The bot whispers enticing flatteries or dirty words. When you touch her, she wriggles. You give her a jump. Then, while the rinse cycle is kicking in, that part is weird, it sounds a little too much like the drain on a dishwasher, you have to fill out a questionnaire, check the ratings boxes for likes and dislikes of this or that feature, suggest improvements. As an on-demand sexual experience, it's said to be better than the bonka chicken racket that used to go on at Positron, they add. No squawking, no scratchy claws. And better than a warm watermelon, too. The latter being not all that responsive. There must be male prostabots for the Jocelyns of this world, thinks Stan. Randy Andy, the handy android. But such an item wouldn't suit Jocelyn, because she wants something that can feel resentment, and even rage. Feel it, and have to repress it. He knows quite a lot about her tastes by now. The night before New Year's Day, she'd made popcorn and insisted they eat it while watching the video prelims. Phil's arrival at the derelict house, his restless pacing, the breath mint he'd slipped into his mouth, his swift preening of himself in the reflection of a shard of glass left in a shattered mirror. The popcorn was greasy with melted butter, but when Stan moved to get a paper towel, Jocelyn laid a hand on his leg. lightly enough, but he knew a command signal when he felt one.
No,
she said, smiling that smile he increasingly can't read. Pain or intent on causing it?
Stay here. I want your butter all over me.
At least it was something extra, that butter. Something Phil and Charmaine hadn't done. Or not on the videos. And so it went on. But toward the end of January, Jocelyn's ardor, or whatever it was, had flagged. She seemed distracted. She worked in her room at the computer she'd set up in there, and instead of wanting sex on the sofa, she'd taken to reading novels on it, with her shoes off and her feet up. He knows more about her now, or more about the story of herself she's using as a front. How did she get into the surveillance business? He'd asked her, for something to do at the breakfast table.
I was an English major, she said. It's a real help.
You're bullshitting me, right?
Not in the least, she said. It's where all the plots are.
That's where you learn the twists and turns. I did my senior thesis on Paradise Lost. Paradise what? The only thing that came to Stan's mind was a nightclub site in Australia he'd once seen online when looking for soft porn. But the place had shut down years before. He wanted to ask Jocelyn if that book was made into an HBO miniseries or something, in case he might have seen it. But he didn't do that because the less ignorance he displayed, the better. Already she was treating him like a brain-damaged spaniel, with a mixture of amusement and contempt. Except when he was in full-throttle pelvic action. But that was happening less and less. Some nights he found himself drinking beer alone because Jocelyn was out of the house. He felt relief. Some of the performance pressure was off. But also fear. Because what if she was about to discard him? And what if the destination she had in mind for him was not Positron Prison, but that unknown void into which the bona fide criminals originally warehoused at Positron had vanished? Jocelyn could erase him. She could just wave her hand and reduce him to zero. She'd never said so, but he knew she had that power. But the 1st of February had come and gone, with no switchover for him. He'd finally dared to bring the subject up. When, exactly, would he be leaving for Positron?
"Missing your chickens?" she'd said.
"Never mind, you might be joining them soon." This made his neck hair stand up. The nature of the chicken feed at Positron was a matter for grisly rumor.
"But first, I want to spend Valentine's Day with you."
The tone was almost sentimental, though there was an underlayer of flint.
"I want it to be special."
Was special a threat? She watched him, smiling a little.
"I don't want us to be interrupted."
"Who'd interrupt us?" he said. In old movies, the kind they showed on the Consilience Channel, comic movies, tragic movies, melodramatic movies, there were frequent interruptions. Someone would burst through a door, a jealous spouse, a betrayed lover. Unless it was a spy movie, in which case it would be a double agent, or a crime movie, in which a stool pigeon had betrayed the gang. Scuffles or gunshots would follow. Escapes from balconies. Bullets to the head. Speedboats zigzagging out of reach. That's what those interruptions led to, though followed by happy endings. But surely no such interrupting was possible here.
"No one, I suppose," she said.
She watched him.
"Charmaine is perfectly safe," she added.
"She's alive and well. I'm not a monster." Then that hand on his knee again. Spider silk, stronger than iron.
"Are you worried?"
"Of course I'm fucking worried," he wanted to shout. "What do you think, you twisted perv? You think it's a kiddie picnic for me, being house slave to a fucking dog trainer who could have me put down at any minute?" But all he'd said was, "No, not really." Then to his shame, "I'm looking forward to it." He's disgusted with himself. What would Connor do in his place? Connor would take charge somehow. Connor would turn the tables. But how?
Looking forward to what?
She said with a blank stare. She was such a gamester.
To what, Stan?
When he stalled. Valentine's Day, he muttered.
What a loser.
Crawl, Stan. Lick shoes. Kiss ass. Your life may be hanging by a thread. She smiled openly this time. That mouth he would soon be obliged to mash with his own, those teeth that would soon be biting his ear.
Good,
she said sweetly, patting his leg.
I'm glad you're looking forward to it.
I like surprises, don't you?
Valentine's Day reminds me of cinnamon hearts. Those little red ones you sucked. Red hots, they were called. Remember?
She licked her lips. Cut the crap, he wanted to say. Drop the fucking innuendo. I know you want to suck my little red hot heart. I need a beer, he said.
Work for it,
she said, abruptly harsh again. She moved her hand up his leg. Squeezed.
Turban. Charmaine is called in to verify her data, sit for the retina scan, repeat the fingerprinting, read Winnie the Pooh for the voice analyzer. Will these steps re-authenticate her profile for the benefit of the database? It's hard to tell. She's still alone in her cell, still shunned by the knitting circle, still stuck in towel folding. But the next day, Aurora from Human Resources turns up in the laundry room and asks Charmaine to accompany her upstairs for a chat. The other towel folders look up. Is Charmaine in trouble? They probably hope so. Charmaine feels at a disadvantage. She's covered in lint, which is diminishing. But she brushes herself off and follows Aurora to the elevator. The chat takes place in the chat room beside the front checkout counter. Aurora is pleased to be able to tell Charmaine that she will have her cards and codes restored to her, or not restored, confirmed. Just as Aurora has been assuring her that the database glitch has been repaired and she is now once again who she's been claiming she is. Aurora smiles tightly. Isn't that good news? Charmaine agrees that it is. At least she has a code identity once again, which is some comfort. So can I leave now? She asks. Go back home? I've missed a lot of out time. Unfortunately, says Aurora, Charmaine can't depart from Positron quite yet. The synchronization is off. Although in theory she might move into the guest room of her own house. Aurora makes a laughing sound. Her alternate is, of course, now living in the house they share, it being that person's turn. Aurora understands how upsetting all this must be for Charmaine, but the proper rotation must be preserved, with no interaction between alternates. Familiarity would inevitably lead to territorial squabbling, especially over such comfort items as sheets and body lotion. As they have all been taught, possessiveness about our cozy corners and favorite toys isn't limited to cats and dogs. How we wish it were! Wouldn't life be simpler? So Charmaine must continue to be patient, says Aurora. And in any case, she's been doing such a good job with the knitting. The blue teddy bears, how many has she knitted now? It must be at least a dozen. She'll have time for a few more of them before she leaves, hopefully at the next switchover day, which is when? The 1st of March, isn't it? And it's almost Valentine's Day, so not long to go. Aurora herself has never learned to knit. She does regret that. It must be calming. Charmaine clenches her hands. One more of those darn teddy bears with their bright unseeing eyes and she's going to go sideways right off the tracks. They've filled bins of them. She has nightmares about those teddies. She dreams that they're in bed with her. Unmoving but alive. Yes, it is calming, she says. Aurora consults her posit pad. she has another piece of good news for Charmaine. As of the day after tomorrow, Charmaine will be taken off towel folding and will resume her former duties as Chief Medications Administrator. Positron does reward talent and experience, and Charmaine's talent and experience have not gone unnoticed. Aurora gives an encouraging grimace. Not everyone has the soft touch, she says. Coupled with such dedication, there have been incidents when other operatives have been tasked with the essential duty. When do I start? Asks Charmaine. Thank you, she adds. She's thrilled to be getting away from the towel folding. She looks forward to re-entering the medications administration wing and following that remembered route along the hallways. She visualizes approaching the desk, accessing the possibly real head on the screen, advancing through the familiar doors, snapping on the gloves, picking up the medication and the hypodermic, then onto the room where her procedure subject will await, immobile but fearful. She will soothe those fears. Then she will deliver bliss, and then release. It will be nice to feel respected again. Aurora consults her posipad again. I see here that you're set to resume your duties tomorrow afternoon, she says. After lunch. When we make a mistake here, we do move to rectify it. Congratulations on a good outcome. We've all been rooting for you. Charmaine wonders who's been doing the rooting, because she hasn't noticed anyone. But like so many things around here, maybe the rooting has taken place behind the scenes. Goodness, I'm late for a meeting, says Aurora. We have a whole new group of prisoners coming in, and all at once. Any further questions or points of information? Yes, says Charmaine. While she herself has been detained in Positron, what has Stan been told about her situation? Surely he's been worried about her. Does he know why she wasn't there, at home? Was he told what happened? Or did he think she'd just been subtracted? Sent to medications? Erased? She hasn't dared to ask about this before. It might have sounded like complaining. It might have cast suspicion. It might have interfered with her chances for exoneration. But she's been cleared now. Stan, says Aurora blankly. Stan, my husband, Stan, says Charmaine. That's not information I have access to, says Aurora, but I'm sure it's been taken care of. Thank you, says Charmaine again. To demand any more answers during this delicate transition that's taking place, this rehabilitation, might be pushing her luck. Then there's Max, kept equally in the dark, longing for her, lusting for her. He must be going crazy. But she couldn't ask Aurora about Max. Could I maybe just send him a message? Charmaine says. Stan, for Valentine's Day? To let him know I'm okay and that I... A tremulous pause on the verge of tears, which she feels she might really shed. That I love him? Aurora stops smiling. No. No messages while in Positron. You know better than that. If prison isn't prison, the outside world has no meaning. Now, enjoy the rest of your experience here. She nods, stands up, and bustles out of the chat room. At least there won't be much more of these darn towels, Charmaine thinks as she folds and stacks. Folds and stacks. Maybe you can get a lung disease from the fluff. As she's wheeling her completed set over to the outtake window, there's a sort of murmuring behind her, coming from the other women in towel folding. She turns to see. It's Ed, the CEO of the Positron Project, ushering in an older woman who isn't wearing an orange boiler suit. On her head, she has something that looks like a turban, decorated with red felt flowers. They're coming toward her. Oh my gosh, Charmaine says. It just sort of comes out of her. Lucinda Quant, I used to love your show, The Home Front. It was so... I'm so glad you got better. She's babbling. She's making a fool of herself. I'm sorry. I shouldn't...
Thanks, says Lucinda Quant gruffly.
She seems pleased. She's quite leathery, or at least her skin is. She didn't used to look like that on TV, but maybe it's the illness.
I'm sure Ms. Quant appreciates your support, says Ed in that suave voice he has. We're giving her a quick tour of our wonderful project. She's considering a new show called After the Home Front, so she can tell the world about the wonderful solution we have here to the problems of homelessness and joblessness.
He smiles at Charmaine. He's standing close to her.
You've been happy here, haven't you? He says, since coming to the project.
Oh, yes, says Charmaine. It's been so... How can she describe what it's been, considering everything, such as Max and Stan? Is she going to cry?
Excellent, Ed says.
He pats her arm and turns away, dismissing her. Lucinda Quant gives Charmaine a sharp glance from her beady, red-rimmed eyes.
Cat got your tongue? She says.
Oh, no, says Charmaine. Is Ed going to make trouble for her because she didn't say the right thing? It's only... I wish I could have been on your show. And she does wish that, because then maybe people would have sent in money, and she and Stan would never have felt the need to sign on.
Shuffle. Stan does the countdown. 2 more days before Valentine's Day. The subject hasn't come up again, but every once in a while he catches Jocelyn looking at him speculatively, as if measuring him. Tonight they're on the sofa as usual, but this time the upholstery will remain unsullied. They're side by side, facing forward like a married couple, which they are, though they're married to other people. But they aren't watching the digital gyrations of Charmaine and Phil tonight. They're watching actual TV. Consilience TV, but still TV. If you drank enough beer, slit your eyes, wiped the context, you could almost believe you were in the outside world. Or the outside world in the past. They've tuned in at the end of a motivational self-help show. So far as Stan can make out, it's about channeling the positive energy rays of the universe through the invisible power points on your body. You do it through the nostrils. Close the right nostril with the index finger, breathe in, open, close the left nostril, breathe out. It gives a whole new dimension to nose picking. The star of the show is a young light-haired woman in a skin-tight pink leotard. She looks familiar, but then such generic women do. Nice tits, especially when she does the right nostril, despite the air bubble chatter coming out of her mouth. So, something for everyone. Self-help and nostrils for the women, tits for the men. Distractions. They don't go out of their way to make you unhappy here. The pink leotard woman tells them to practice every day, because if you focus, focus, focus on positive thoughts, you'll attract your own luck to yourself and shut out those negative thoughts that try to get in. They can have such a toxic effect on your immune system, leading to cancer and also to outbreaks of acne, because the skin is the body's largest organ and extra sensitive to negativity. Then she tells them that next week the feature will be pelvic alignment, so they should all reserve their yoga mats at the gym. She signs off with a freeze-frame smile. Could that be Sandy? Stan wonders. Charmaine's erstwhile low-rent friend from Pixel Dust? No. Too pretty. New music comes on. Somewhere Over the Rainbow, sung by Judy Garland. And with it, the Consilience logo. Consilience equals cons plus resilience. Due time now. Buy time for our future. Yes, it's another town meeting. Stan yawns, tries not to yawn again. He opens his eyes wider. Here come the usual head deadeners. The graphs. The statistics. The hectoring disguised as uplift. Violent incidents are down for the third time in a row, says a small guy in a tight suit. And let's keep that arrow moving. Shot of a graph. Egg production is up again. Another graph. Then a shot of eggs rolling down a chute and an automatic counter registering each egg with a digitized number. Stan has a pang of nostalgia. Those chickens and eggs were once his chickens and eggs. They were his responsibility, and yes, his tranquility. But now, all that has been taken away from him, and he's been demoted to chief toe-licker for Jocelyn the Spook. Suck it up, he tells himself. Close the right nostril, breathe in. Now another face comes on. It's Ed, the confidence man, on screen to make them all feel confident. But an Ed who's more substantial and assured, weightier in manner, more full of himself. Maybe he scored a major contract. In any case, he's puffed up with the importance of what he's about to deliver. The project has been going well, says Ed. Their unit, here at Consilience, was the first, the pioneering town, and others in the chain have similarly prospered. Head office is getting inquiries daily from other stricken communities who see the project as a way of solving their own problems, both economic and social. There are different, more old-fashioned solutions to these problems. Louisiana has kept its honey hole model, the for-profit hosting of recalcitrants from other states, and Texas is still dealing with its criminality statistics by means of executions. But many jurisdictions are looking for a more rewarding, for a more humane, or at least a more... for something more like Consilience. There is every reason to believe that their twin city is being viewed at a high level as a possible model for the future. Full employment is hard to beat, he smiles. But now, a frown. In fact, says Ed, the model has been shown to be so effective, so conducive to social order, and because of that, so positive in economic terms, and indeed so positive for the supporters and visionaries who'd had the courage and moral fiber to see a way forward in a time of multiple challenges, the Consilience model has been, in a word, so successful that it has created enemies, as successful enterprises always do. Where there is light, it does seem a rule that darkness will shortly appear, as it now has, he is sorry to inform them. An even deeper frown, a thrusting of the forehead, a lowering of the chin, a raising of the shoulders, an angry bull stance. Who are these enemies? First of all, they are reporters, muckraking journalists trying to worm their way in, to get evidence, to get pictures and other material that they can distort for so-called exposés, in order to turn the outside world against everything the Positron Project stands for. These shady, so-called reporters aim to undermine the foundations of returning prosperity and to chip away at trust. That trust without which no society can function in a stable manner. Several journalists have actually made it inside the wall, pretending they wanted to sign on, but luckily they were identified in time. For instance, just the other day, a female TV journalist with excellent credentials had been given a mini-tour under strict conditions of confidentiality, but had been discovered in the act of taking clandestine pictures intended to present a slanted view. How to explain the wish of such people to sabotage such an excellent venture? Except by saying they are maladjusted misfits who claim to be acting as they do in the interests of so-called press freedom, and in order to restore so-called human rights, and under the pretense that transparency is a virtue and the people need to know. But isn't it a human right to have a job? Ed believes it is, and enough to eat, and a decent place to live, which Consilience provides. Those are surely human rights. These enemies, not to mince words, says Ed, have already been involved in stirring up protest gatherings, luckily quite small ones, and have been writing hostile blog posts, though happily without credibility. None of this has gone very far as yet, because what evidence do such malcontents have for their scurrilous allegations? Scurrilous allegations that he will not dignify by repeating. These people and their networks must be identified, and then they must be neutralized. For otherwise, what will happen? The consilience model will be threatened. It will be attacked on all sides by what may seem at first like small forces. But together in a mob, those forces are not small. They are catastrophic. Just as one rat is negligible, but a million rats is an infestation, a plague. So the sternest of measures must be taken before things get out of control. A solution is required. And such a solution has indeed been devised, though not without much careful thought and the rejection of less viable alternatives. It is the best solution available at this time and in this place. They can take Ed's word for that. And this is where he needs their cooperation. For the jewel in the middle of consilience, Positron Prison, to which they have all given so much of their time and attention, Positron Prison has been chosen for a vital role in that solution. Every resident of consilience will have a part to play, if only by keeping out of harm's way and being alert to subversion from within. But for the present, they can best help by simply going about their daily routine as if nothing unusual is happening, despite the unavoidable disruptions that may occur in that routine from time to time. Though it is earnestly hoped that such disruptions will be kept to a minimum. Remember, says Ed, these enemies, if they succeeded, would destroy everyone's job security and very way of life. They should all bear that in mind. He has great faith in the common sense of the citizens of consilience, and in their ability to recognize the greater good and to choose the lesser evil. He allows himself a tiny smile. Then he is replaced by the consilience logo and the familiar sign-off slogan, A Meaningful Life. Stan has found this news of interest, if it is news. Are there really subversives? Are they really trying to undermine the project? What would be the point? He himself has fucked his life up, but for the other people in here, anyone he knows at least, this place beats the hell out of what they had before. He looks sideways at Jocelyn. She's staring thoughtfully at the screen, on which a toddler in the Positron preschool is playing with a blue knitted teddy bear, a ribbon around its neck. They've taken to running kitty pictures after the town meetings, as if to remind everyone not to stray off the course Consilience has set for them, because wouldn't they be endangering the security and happiness of these little ones? No one but a child abuser would do that. Jocelyn switches the TV off, then sighs. She's looking tired. She knew what Ed was going to say, Stan thinks. She's in on his solution, whatever it is. Maybe she wrote the speech. Do you believe in free will? She asks. Her voice is different. It's not her usual confident tone. Is this some kind of trap? How do you mean? Says Stan. The first truck arrives the next morning. It's unloaded at the main gates. Stan sees this as he scooters to work. The people herded out are wearing the regulation orange boiler suits, but they're hooded, their hands plastic-cuffed behind their backs. Instead of being driven straight to Positron, they're shuffled along the street, shepherded by a batch of guards. The prisoners must have some way of seeing out the front. They don't stumble as much as you'd think. Some are women, judging from the shapes muffled beneath their baggy clothing. No need to parade them like this, unless it's a demonstration, thinks Stan. A demonstration of power. What's been going on in the turbulent world outside the closed fishbowl of consilience? No, not a fishbowl. Because no one can see in. The other guys in the scooter repair depot glance up as the silent procession shuffles past, then returned to their work. "Sometimes you miss the newspaper," one of them says. No one replies.
Threat. Charmaine saw the town meeting on TV, along with everyone else in the women's wing. Nobody had much to say about it, because whatever was happening wouldn't affect them, especially while they were inside the prison, so why worry about it? "In any case," said someone in the knitting circle, "so what if a reporter got in? Because what could they report?" There wasn't anything bad going on inside Consilience. The bad stuff was on the outside. That's why all of them had come in, to get away from it. Nods all round. Charmaine isn't so sure. What if some reporter happened to find out about the procedure? Not everyone would understand about that. They wouldn't understand the reasons for it, the good reasons. You could put a really unpleasant headline on such a story. She has a flash of herself and a front page photo in her green smock, smiling eerily and holding a needle. Death Angel claims she sent men to heaven. That would be horrible. She'd be the target of a lot of hate. But Ed won't let the reporters get in here, and thank goodness for that. The next evening, after the communal meal in the women's dining room, chicken stew, Brussels sprouts, tapioca pudding, they all file into the main space, where the knitting circle meets. The teddy bear bin is half empty. It's their task to fill it before the month is out. Charmaine takes up her allotted bear and sets to work. But when she's done only two rows, one knit, one purl, there's a stir. Heads turn. A man has walked into the room. This is almost unheard of here in the women's wing. It's Ed himself, looking the same as when she saw him in towel folding, though less relaxed. His shoulders are back more. His chin is up. It's a marching stance. Behind him is Aurora with her posi pad, and another woman. Black hair, squarish face, a strong body, like someone who works out a lot. Boxing, not yoga. Nice legs and gray stockings. Charmaine recognizes her. She's one of the talking heads from the validation screen in Medications Administration. So those heads are real after all. She's always wondered about that. Is it her imagination? Or has this woman singled her out? Given her a brief nod, a quick smile? Maybe she's a secret ally. One of the behind-the-scenes rooters. One of those who's restored Charmaine to her rightful job. Charmaine gives a little nod in her direction, just in case. Aurora speaks first. "Here is Ed, their president and CEO. They will, of course, recognize him from his excellent town meeting presentations, and he has some very simple but very crucial instructions to give them at this juncture." Ed begins with a smile and a gaze around the room. On the TV, he's always friendly, makes eye contact. He somehow includes everyone in. He's doing that now, putting them at their ease. He begins to talk. He knows they've seen the town meeting, and he has something to add about the crisis they are all facing. Well, it isn't a crisis yet, and it's his job, and their job too, to make sure that it never becomes one. Scrutiny from the outside world is something Ed welcomes. He's happy to go out and speak on behalf of all of them here and to gather support, but he will not allow the inmates to be pestered and slandered, because that is the aim of those who are set against them, pestering and slandering. Why should they be subjected to such treatment? It would be most unfair after all the hard work they've been doing. The women are nodding. He has their sympathy. How thoughtful he is, protecting them in this way. "The situation is under control," he continues, "but meanwhile, he's calling upon all of them to exert themselves even more than usual in order to repel the barbarians at the gates who have declared themselves against the new way of ordering society they have been creating right here. The new order that is a beacon of hope, a beacon that risks being deliberately sabotaged. But necessary steps are being taken. Some of those saboteurs have been identified, and they are being brought right here to Positron to be dealt with. Sticklers might not view such a move as strictly legal, but desperate situations require a certain bending of the rules, as he is sure they will agree. He would ask them to help out in the following ways. No fraternizing with those new-style prisoners, even if an opportunity may present itself. Any unusual sounds are to be ignored. He can't say what these sounds might be, other than unusual, but they will know them when they hear them. Otherwise, they are to carry on as normal, and to mind, he will put this colloquially, to mind their own business. As if it's been orchestrated, there's a scream. It's distant, hard to say whether it's a man or a woman, but it's definitely a scream. Charmaine holds herself perfectly still. She wills herself not to turn her head. Did this scream come over the sound system? Was it from outside, in the yard? There is an imperceptible rustling among the women as they steel themselves against hearing. Ed has paused a little to make room for the scream. Now he continues. And finally, he says, he will now share with them, and he does apologize for this, during this crisis, and he does expect it to be cleared up soon, Positron Prison will not be the comfortable and familiar haven of friends and neighbors that they have helped to nourish. Regrettably, it will become a less trusting and open place. Because that is what happens in a crisis. People must be on guard. They must be sharper. They must be harder. But after this interlude, if the forces acting for the greater good are successful, the normal, pleasant, and congenial atmosphere will return. Now, he hopes they will relax and keep on with what they're doing. He'll just stroll around and watch them at their work, because it is deeply encouraging to him to see them so peacefully and usefully employed. I guess that means keep on knitting, Charmaine's neighbor says to her. The knitting circle is being friendlier to her now that they know she's got her old job back. What was he talking about? Says another. What sounds? I didn't hear anything. We don't need to know, says a third. When people talk like that, it means don't even listen is what they mean. I didn't get that about a crisis, says a fourth. Did something blow up? Dang it to heck, thinks Charmaine. I dropped a stitch. Then Ed is standing right beside her. He must have crept up.
That's an attractive blue bear you're knitting, he says to her. It will make someone very happy.
Charmaine looks up at him. He's against the light. She can hardly see him. I'm not very good at it, she says.
Oh, I'm sure you are,
he says as he turns away. It comes to her in a flash. He knows about Max. She can feel herself blushing with shame. Now, why did she have that thought? Why would he have any reason to know? He's too important to be bothered with people like her. She only had that thought because of the way she is. The way she can't shake Max out of her head. Out of her body. The way she can't get clear.
Valentine's Day. It's Valentine's Day. Stan lies in bed. He doesn't want to get up because he doesn't want to plod through the hours ahead, expecting to be ambushed at any minute by whatever foul or embarrassing surprise Jocelyn's planning to spring on him. Will it be a red cake, plus tawdry, heart-sprinkled, crotchless lingerie for Jocelyn, or worse, for himself? Will there be a soppy and mortifying declaration of love from her, with the expectation of an equally soppy and mortifying one from him in return? Hard-shelled women like her can have slushy interiors. Or will it be option B? We're done here. You fail. Sandbagged to the back of the skull from the lurking goon she's got hidden in the broom closet. He casts her regular chauffeur for that, supposing there is one and not merely a bot. Then a needle in the arm to keep him out cold. Then dragged into that creepy stealth car with the darkened windows and hauled off to Positron to be processed in whatever way they process people there. Then into the chicken feed grinder, or wherever they dispose of the parts. The cake and the melting, tender, velvet-eyed confession, or the iron-fisted sandbagging. She's capable of either.